I hear of Sherlock everywhere, episode 41, The Woman.
I hear of Sherlock everywhere since you became astronomer.
In a world where it's always 1895, comes I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, a podcast for devotees of Mr. Sherlock Holmes, the world's first unofficial consulting detective.
I've heard of you before. You're Holmes the meddler, Holmes the busybody, Holmes the Scotland Yard jack in office.
The game's afoot as we discuss goings-on in the world of Sherlock Holmes enthusiasts, the Bigger Street irregulars, and popular culture related to the great detective.
As we go to press, sensational developments have been reported.
So join your hosts, Scott Monty and Burt Walder, as they talk about what's new in the world of Sherlock Holmes.
You couldn't have come at a better time!
Ah, yes, that must be our cue. Welcome back, or welcome to I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, the first podcast for Sherlock Holmes devotees where it's always 1895. I'm Scott Monty.
And I'm Burt Walder.
And that means we are poised here on the edge of our seats, as you must be on yours, as opposed to the end of the show where you'll be slumped and nearly comatose, to talk about some of the things that are going on in the world of Sherlock Holmes in the present day, 2012, that would be.
Yes. Oh, it's a 2012. It's, yeah.
Oh, are we already here? Yeah. Yes. Wind your calendar. Yes. Or as a former radio man would say, woo, 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 wind up your radio, Dementites and Dementoids. We'll see if anybody gets that reference. But before we get into the meat of our show, let's get to the potatoes.
Yes, we have to salute our noble sponsor, the Wessex Press.
Yes, for all your pressing needs, the Wessex Press presses them like none other.
Like none other. Yes, no starch used when we press our Wessexes.
But wait a minute, if this is the potatoes of our show, that is a starch. But starch, of course, is made of celluloid, and one of the Wessex Press's latest publications is a study in celluloid. A producer's account of Jeremy Brett as Sherlock Holmes, as written and updated by Michael Cox, the executive producer of the Granada series that was made from the mid-1980s through the early 1990s, with Jeremy Brett in that definitive portrayal of Sherlock Holmes. The study in celluloid kind of chronicles how the series came to be and looks at each episode as it was produced. Absolutely fascinating account.
And we've mentioned in the past that you can also get from the Wessex Press the definitive collection of really everything to do with Conan Doyle's first Sherlockian play, The Speckled Band.
Yes, as illustrated in the Illustrated Speckled Band, the original 1910 stage production. In script and photographs there. And in addition to the nice folks at Wessex Press, whom you can find, by the way, at wessexpress.com, we have another sponsor. We are proud to announce in this episode, episode 41, we are adding to our list of sponsors the Baker Street Journal.
You don't mean an entire journal just for Baker Street.
It would seem so. Yes. Yes. Never before has so much been written by so many for so few. The Baker Street Journal, having been published nearly continuously since 1946, I think there are three missing quarters, the missing three quarters in the 1950s there when they took a hiatus. Since 1946, four times a year, plus a Christmas annual, the Baker Street Journal has been churning out Sherlockian scholarship. And you hear some of that on each episode, or on nearly on each episode here, as we read the editor's Gas Lamp, which we will do later in this episode. So we are proud.
We are.
To have the journal joining us. You can find the Baker Street Journal at bakerstreetjournal.com. There are a number of books that you can take a look at that they have for sale there. And you can browse through some of the samples of the scholarship that have been posted there and that have also graced the pages of the journal as well.
And as part of every subscription, and really if you have any interest in anything at all to do with Sherlock Holmes, and you must since you're listening to us, you owe it to yourself to subscribe to the Baker Street Journal. And free with every subscription in the United States, your issue of the Baker Street Journal will not only be printed and bound and put in an envelope, just as the ancients used to do with their publications, but it will be brought to your home by a uniformed representative of the United States government.
Look at that. That is amazing that the journal has that kind of power.
It is. Well, from presidents to postmen, you know, Franklin Delano Roosevelt was a member of the Baker Street Irregulars, and ever since then, we've insisted on nothing but the best.
Indeed, indeed. And you know, the fascinating thing for me, at least, about the Baker Street Journal, and I've been a subscriber since, I want to say the early 1990s or so, is the fact that I get to get inside the head of so many other Sherlockians out there. You know, you can go to meetings, you can read things on the web or share them through Facebook or whatnot. But it isn't until you get into some of this in-depth scholarship that you really understand what makes some people tick and quite frankly, may even produce a bit of some of us. So it's absolutely fascinating for me to get inside the minds of fellow Sherlockians through their contributions to the Baker Street Journal.
Mm.
How long have you been a subscriber, Bert?
Well, boy, oh boy. I'll have to go back and find my first issue, but I certainly in the late 1960s I began subscribing because I discovered all this after the Baring Gould annotated. That's what clued me into the Baker Street Journal when I was in high school. And so 1968, 1969, I think I started subscribing. And let me see. Is that right? Yeah, I guess. Yeah, the very late 60s. So, somewhere. And I have, you know, we've kept all those issues. And the nice part is, I guess, is that still for sale? Can you still buy the CDs with all of the...
I believe so. In 2001 or so, which actually, that was the time I was asked to join as a volunteer the Baker Street Journal staff. My contribution to the journal was not anything scholarly, of course, but was actually to put the Baker Street Journal online at bakerstreetjournal.com because at that very same time we were selling a CD-ROM of the first 50 years of the journal. And we figured, well, what better place to sell it than online, because people that have computers are likely the ones that will find it online and use that CD-ROM. So if you go to items for sale, there should be a BSJ CD-ROM there, which takes you from 1946 through 2000 or so. And as I understand it, there is an update being made that will bring us up to date for the 10 or 12 years that have transpired since then. So you can actually find all sorts of great information in the back issues simply by using a CD-ROM. I know part of my own interest as a collector is actually getting the actual back issues of the journal. And I think I'm only missing one at this point. But you can usually find those at, used book dealers, eBay, whatnot. And it's one of the – I think it's one of the – first issues of the new series. Remember I mentioned that missing three quarters there. I think it was 1950-51. I've got three of the four issues of that first year. So that's the only gap in my collection at this point.
Good for you.
But that's part of the fun. And you know, if we can continue this shameless plug for our sponsor, but I don't really feel like it's a plug since it's something that's pretty interesting and appropriate to what we're talking about. If you actually don't want to go the length of getting all the back issues and flipping through, even though serendipity alone could bring you dozens upon dozens of topics as you leaf through the old issues there, there is a way to get the best of the best. the Baker Street Journal online there has produced a 2-volume series by edited by Laurie R. King and Leslie S. Klinger. And, of course, you'll remember we had Les here on the show a few episodes ago. The 2-volume series is called The Grand Game, a celebration of Sherlockian scholarship. And The Grand Game pulls, of course, from the Baker Street Journal as some of its source material. But you will get the best Sherlockian scholarship from 1902 to present. Volume 1 takes you from 1902 to 1959. Volume 2 from 1960 to the present. Laurie and Les have taken great pains in finding the best scholarship out there that represents everything about the Sherlockian world. Everything from, of course, Vincent Sterrett's classic 221B Baker Street sonnet to H.W. Bell's classic Three Identifications, Lauriston Gardens, Upper Swandam Lane, Saxe Coburg Square, where he actually went into London and tried to identify exactly where some of the locations were in real life. The great two-parter under radical criticism, the Rex Stout, Watson Was a Woman, and the response by Julian Wolfe, That Was No Lady. So classics of Sherlockian scholarship in The Grand Game. So that brings us to a topic that we are really, really excited to address here. Of course, we recently, I think 2 episodes ago, spoke with the Baker Street Babes about this Believe in Sherlock movement that was going on. And that was related to season 2 of the BBC Sherlock series. Well, of course, the time has come now when the U.S., whether it's prepared or not, will be receiving the episodes of the new Sherlock series through the PBS Masterpiece Mystery show. And that is scheduled to debut on Sunday, May the 6th on PBS. Check your local listings for time and stations. But that is when the new season 2 of Sherlock will debut.
The magnificent thing about the BBC Sherlock is that it came from the mind of Mark Gatiss and Stephen Moffat, who are experienced actors, producers, and writers of a variety of things in Britain. But they're also very dedicated Sherlockians. And I think the guiding impetus for the BBC Sherlock was to recreate the connection between Sherlock Holmes and his contemporary audience that existed in the 1890s today. You know, it's well known in Sherlockian lore that when Holmes was thought to be dead in Reichenbach, there was a massive negative public reaction, and it's been reported that people queued up at the newsstands to buy The Final Problem, and some wore black armbands. And that spoke of a time when Holmes was more than just a character in popular culture, but someone who had captured the imagination of a wide and growing public. And I think the inspiration for the BBC Sherlock was, what would we need to do that again today? And the team of Gatiss and Moffat and Sue Virtue and the rest of them have done it. You know, they have created on television that living, breathing Holmes and Watson that seems, particularly to the residents of London, to be very, very real. Hence, the I Believe in Sherlock Holmes phenomenon.
they really have. And the output of that, the result and the response from the audience has been entirely unscripted. I mean, we saw what happened, or at least we know of what happened in the 1890s when Holmes was wiped off the literary map for a bit of a time there. The response that we've seen, and of course, as we make our way through the 3 episodes that make up season 2 of Sherlock, it happened just naturally. It's not because it was forced. I saw someone say that it was a marketing ploy. It really wasn't. The emotional connection that was created between the audience and these characters, they cared about the storylines. They cared about the characters and cared enough that they actually took their movement to the streets, literally to the streets.
Yeah, and without, you know, without being a spoiler for those of you who haven't seen the shows of season two, you know, if you relate this back to your experience of Holmes, Holmes believed to be dead and lost in Reichenbach, and that massive outpouring of grief, it's safe to say that there are events in the episodes that comprise series two that, you know, put Holmes in a sort of a similar emotional state. And the outpouring, if you haven't been participating in this online, the outpouring of it were people who were moved to make up signs and placards and to post basically the phrase, "Look, I believe in Sherlock. You know, I believe in this guy." And it's a phenomenon that thousands have participated in all across Europe, not just in London.
Indeed, indeed. And we're looking forward to seeing how it rolls out over the course of May of 2012 here as the show makes its debut on PBS. Now, we have a clip from the show that we have embedded on iHearOfSherlock.com. You can check it out under episode 41 here. We've embedded on the site, as well as links to pre-order the Season 2 DVD on standard DVD or Blu-ray. You can get a hold of that and order it already. It's already been available in the UK, but it's also available now for ordering in the US, and we've made that link available to you.
The first thing you will find when Season 2 begins in May is an episode called A Scandal in Belgravia, which it would not tax your deductive powers too much to connect to the Sherlockian tale of a scandal in Bohemia. And this, in fact, features on the screen, on your very own screen, the woman, Irene Adler.
And we are lucky enough this very episode to have not just a woman, but the woman with us, Miss Lara Pulver, who played Irene Adler in A Scandal in Belgravia.
Hey, good evening. Good day to you guys.
Good evening to you, Lara. Where in the world are you? Are you in the UK?
I'm currently in Chichester in the UK.
Oh, well, thanks for taking the time. It's late in your day.
Yeah, it is, but it's a pleasure.
I think one of the things that Scott and I are most curious about is what did you think when you first saw the show? If I remember, you first came across Sherlock when you were in L.A., I think, in Parade. Is that right? And you saw it on PBS as all the other viewers
did? Yeah, I saw it on PBS.
So what did you think? What did you think when you saw it?
It was just the classiest piece of television I'd seen in a long time. It was witty. I was gripped. I was intrigued. And I couldn't wait for the next episode. It just felt really refreshing. It felt like a really intelligent piece of television that challenged the viewer and didn't underestimate the audience's intelligence. Hmm.
And did you come to it as a fan of Sherlock Holmes? Had you read the stories when you were younger?
I remember reading some Conan Doyle when I was at school, but I wasn't an avid fan by any means. But the second I got Stephen Moffat's script through, it was just such a gift of a role that he'd written that I was ready to fight for that role.
and when you read it, did you remember who Irene Adler was in the original story?
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. And I just remember loving Moriarty as well from reading them. I was totally intrigued to jump into that world.
Well, and we're recording this, and we're going to be airing it before the PBS version airs on May 6th. So trying to keep it spoiler-free, but what were your thoughts of seeing Irene Adler portrayed as a dominatrix of all things?
I thought it was genius, to be honest, that Stephen had given her this this persona where she, as her job, she's fearless. She's in control. She's powerful, and it's such a kind of physical and visual career. So to know she was then so articulate of mind as well when it came to Sherlock. It was kind of fascinating that she just literally used her body as a device, as a tool.
Mm. Well, yeah, and there are a few 21st century occupations left for adventurous. You know, you never see adventurous on a business card anymore. So to make Irene Adler relevant in the 21st century, you know, you really need those elements of power and mystery and command. And it is extraordinarily clever.
Absolutely. And then throw in the fact that she was she had possible information or was involved in a member of the royal family. Just... I thought, how witty and intriguing to do that.
So how much of the character was on the page, and how much of it came from you and working with Gatiss and Moffat?
To be honest, Stephen had written such a well-defined script. You know, there's very few writers, television writers like him, who write such a three-dimensional character on the page that you can just devour and just flesh out, really. A lot of it was there. However, what I loved is he got the real humour, and he got the real tennis match or the chess game between the two of them. What I also wanted to bring to the table was very much her vulnerability, and when Sherlock and Irene were challenging themselves to the point of rawness and vulnerability. That's something I very much wanted people to understand, so that the audience could like her and see where she was coming from. That was really important to me.
You know, like Professor Moriarty, Irene Adler really only has one appearance in the Sherlock Holmes. Are there any hopes for any developments beyond the episode in which you played her? I know the team has discussed a season 3. Are any hopes of bringing Irene Adler back potentially for another episode, or any vision that you might have or hopes that you might have?
It's one of those situations where it was such a wonderfully directed, you know, acted across the board. I think it was such a well put together episode that sometimes it's great to leave something as a bit of a one-off. However, I completely trust Stephen and Mark and know that if they do bring her back, it will serve the audience, the fans, and myself alike. And it will either be so unexpected, or it'll be in a very witty, clever way. So I completely trust them. I know that they're starting to think about season 3, and they'll start shooting it in January. So we shall see. We shall see. But I'm more than happy to work with Stephen and Mark alike. On whatever project, because I just think they're writing some of the best pieces of television right now. So,
well, it's unbelievable. I mean, but it's what, you know, it's what you get from their producing talents, but also the acting experience. I mean, they really bring everything to the table, and the passion about the characters and the background and the creativity. It's really remarkable.
Yeah, it's very rare. I remember walking into the table read for Sherlock season 2. And it's very rare when you walk in and they've just won BAFTAs and they've just been nominated for Emmys, and you walk into a room and there's this lovely ease and confidence in their product, because across the board, both behind the camera, creatively, from a cast point of view, the puzzle just fits. And that's when true genius can be created. And that's what it felt like. I was jumping into this cauldron where the ingredients were just right. So what a gift it was then to kind of fly alongside them off the back of their success of Series 1.
What? Not intimidating at all, huh?
you know what? Of course it was scary, but if you give into that fear, then you're not doing yourself any service. So I rode with it. I rode with the joy of them all, and just bounced off actors like Benedict and Martin, who were just a gift to work alongside.
Yeah, yeah. Now, in terms of from when you first received the script through the table read and the entire production, how long did the episode take to produce and shoot and everything?
We rehearsed for a week, and then we had a 4-week shoot on the episode, with it being a 90-minute episode. So it's kind of shot like a movie. that's hence why we only make three a season, because a lot of work goes into it, a lot of prep, a lot of pre-production, and it is a 90-minute episode. So we take 5 weeks to rehearse and shoot it.
Boy, oh boy. There are a lot of people who envy you the week of rehearsal and the four-week production time. Wow, that's a good
show. Know. Well, you know, I came off of True Blood, which was a 12-day episode, for a 48 or 52-minute episode or whatever it is that we amount to. So having 5 weeks, and still we were pushed. It wasn't like we had the luxury to have 15 takes. It's just what goes into it. The cinematography, what goes into even that element, you know, what Paul McGuigan as a director brings to that. It's so detailed. I remember reading the montage sequence, without giving too much away of the first episode, where we flip back between being outdoors and indoors. And the sequence just came together thanks to Paul McGuigan's eye of being able to see what was on the page and make it live. And that takes like a few days to shoot. So we're very privileged to have that time.
Yeah. Oh, and you're very privileged in the locations too. I mean, without giving anything away, you know, you are out in the country, and then I think you were at the Battersea Power Station, weren't? Wasn't some of that shot there?
Correct.
You were all over the place. Unbelievable. And then in Cardiff, were you also in Cardiff, I think?
Yes, we shoot all the interior of Baker Street in Cardiff, and then shoot the exterior in London.
Yeah, I was actually just there a couple of weeks ago at North Gower Street, I think, is the external for Baker Street.
In Gower Street, correct? Yeah.
And how about the scenes? Go ahead.
Sorry, I was just about to say that's where you see tourists getting confused, where we suddenly turn up and put Baker Street signs over the Gower Street sign, and all of a sudden you see the confusion of people looking at their ATVs, thinking, my God, where am I?
I know. Well, I use Foursquare for, kind of location-based check-ins on my iPhone.
Uh-huh.
And nobody had actually tagged it as 221B Baker Street, so I actually put it in there. So now there's two 221B Baker Streets in London. So.
Adding to the confusion. I like that.
Obviously the episode is titled A Scandal in Belgravia. Where were the external shots done for Irene Adler's residence, Belgravia?
We were in a beautiful side street. I'm trying to recall where we were. My memory fails me. Where were our exteriors? We were definitely in London. I don't think we were necessarily in Belgravia. Mm-hmm. Where were we? My goodness,
If you can't figure it out, I'm sure we have a couple of fans that can ferret it out for us.
Quick, get Stephen Moffat on the phone, quick.
I actually had a very
brief... was 9 months ago now.
understandable. That's a long time. I actually had a very brief chat with him in Austin, Texas, at the South by Southwest Festival. He and Sue were down there.
I was so disappointed. I was supposed to be there. Yeah, I was supposed to be there joining him, but unfortunately, I was doing a play in London, so I couldn't be there.
What were you doing? What play?
I'm currently doing Uncle Vanya.
Oh my goodness!
So I'm in the world of Chekhov for another 3 weeks.
Wow! And how's that going?
Incredibly well. It's again, such wonderful language. We're doing the Michael Frayn translation of Uncle Vanya, and it's just a gift of language that I get to explore every night. I feel blessed. I've had such a diverse start to the year, I can't wait to then come back to the States for when Sherlock airs.
And you've done so much. You began, didn't you, in musicals. I mean, you're an accomplished singer and dancer in addition to your dramatic gifts.
I am indeed, yes. When I left drama school, I fell into about 4 or 5 years of back-to-back musical theatre, which ended in me doing Parade at the Dunmore Warehouse with Rob Ashford directing, which is the Jason Robert Brown piece and Alfred Uhry. And that transferred to Los Angeles to the Mark Taper Forum Theatre. So I came out to LA, and 3.5 years later, I was still living there. having a whale of time working on True Blood with Alan Ball and Anna Paquin and Alex Skarsgård and the entire team.
I know it's hard. It's unfair to ask, but what do you prefer? I mean, if somebody said to you, "No, Lara, here's what we could do. We could do a couple of films. Uh-huh. We could do a couple of musicals. We could do some drama. Pick one first." What would you pick first?
Them all. I'm so greedy. Do you know what I love the most, actually? It's bouncing from one to the other, because you then learn and you grow and you suddenly realize, you know, sometimes there's a terrible stimulus put on musical theater actors. And I think often when it's done well, they are the most talented of performers, because they can encompass everything. Not only are they wonderful actors, but, you know, I've been watching the program Smash that Steven Spielberg produces for NBC, and the talent, you know, the people like Catherine McPhee are offering up, it's remarkable. And not many actors have those tools in their bag. So I'm really proud to come from a musical theatre background and have the ability and the option to be able to jump from doing theatre to television to film. It's a very fortunate position to be in, and one that I'm very grateful for.
Did you know at an early age this was what you wanted to do? Were you struck by the musical theatre when you were very young?
I don't ever remember the moment of thinking I wanted to be an actor, but from the age of six, I had a scrapbook called Hi Diddly Dee, It's an Actor's Life for me. So from a very young age, I was choreographing dance routines to Michael Jackson and making my poor family sit down and watch it for 20 minutes and started selling my mum's perfume in the interval for some unknown reason. I don't quite know what the thought was behind that. So to answer your question, I don't remember ever wanting to do anything else. But I was very fortunate to then audition for drama school and get a scholarship and then work with the National Youth Music Theatre and gain some training there. And knock on wood, I've had a wonderful 10-year career so far, which has been really diverse and has brought me here talking to you guys today, having just worked with Benedict Cumberbatch and Martin Freeman. So I'm thoroughly enjoying every stage of my career, really, and just pinching myself at times for the girl who just wanted to do Michael Jackson routines in front of her grandparents.
Well, don't pinch yourself too hard, because I think this episode that you're doing with us is probably the low point of your career. So.
I take that as a compliment. Thank you.
Now, speaking of your grandparents and your family, without giving anything away to our listeners who haven't seen the episode yet, but did you get any family reaction from a scandal in Belgravia? Were there any? Was there any throat clearing? Was there any tisk tisks?
Let's just say my bank manager couldn't look me in the eye when I had to go and do my mortgage renewal. But, you know, it's shot so cleverly, and I won't give anything away, but yes. But you don't need to hide behind the cushion. It's fine. It's purely a minute and a half scene of hopefully wonderful television. So
it was the best minute and a half of my life.
It is absolutely wonderful.
Oh, thank you very much indeed.
So how does it feel to be Irene Adler, you know, the equal of this, the equal, if not superior, of this great detective? What did that feel like when you fully assembled that character?
It was hugely empowering, and it was, for the first time in my life, I felt really proud to be a woman. I think I've always been proud to be a woman, but it was a moment when I just encompassed everything, the flaws, everything, the vulnerability, the rawness, the fears of being a woman and what that entails, and just laying it out there, you know, really raw. And it's amazing how attractive and how charming vulnerability can be. And it was just something that Benedict and I just explored by literally playing tennis on set with each other. And he's such a wonderful actor and so responsive that it just meant that, and Martin Freeman too, it just meant that we could just really, really play around with the characters and see how far we could take them, really, to what extremes we could take them.
Well, it's been a lot of fun as a viewer. You know, of course, Bert and I have seen the episode already. We've seen all the episodes, and just a remarkable, remarkable bit of programming. The entire series, really, as you yourself said. And really, really appreciate your take on this iconic character. It's so easy to lampoon it and to just mail it in because, you know, like Professor Moriarty, like, you know, Irina, these are characters that, because they've only had one appearance, they're almost one-dimensional. And I think you've really brought three dimensions to the role. And just the way you've talked about it today, absolutely fascinating to hear how you've actually breathed life into this this really remarkable woman.
And I think that there could be a lot ahead, you know, in addition to a musical, which we could call Irene. There's also, I tell you, I would watch a series pretty regularly on her adventures.
Well, Stephen Moffat needs to start writing that one.
A little spin-off. I like that.
Yeah. Wonderful. Well, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you.
Lara Pulver, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you.
Bye now. She eclipses and predominates the whole of her sex.
What a great and talented woman.
Yeah.
She is. And I love that story that she told about her scrapbook when she was a girl. Hi, diddle-dee-dee, an actor's life for me.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. I think I had one when I was six. A podcaster's life for me.
Even then, people were looking at you askance.
There you go. Well, you know, we actually are lucky enough this episode to have a comment from a loyal listener and fan.
Excellent.
So let me just get to that.
Well, do we want to talk a little bit more about Pulver? Do we want to say anything more about Pulver? I mean, it really was nice of her to take the time, you know, particularly so late in her day.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we're here on the East Coast and she's over in London.
She's been in Vanya, so
yeah.
You know, she's got to clean up, pack up, go home, and then, you know, as midnight looms, talk to these guys in the States. That's very good of her.
Yeah, yes, indeed. I of course, we've been trying for other luminaries in the series, and just because of their real frenetic schedules with other projects that they're involved in, we haven't yet been able to nail them down. But maybe they'll listen to Lara's episode here and become, well, either inspired or horrified. I don't know. We'll let them draw the conclusion.
Yeah. And for those of you who have not seen Scandal in Belgravia, you are going to see, let's put it this way, you are certainly going to see the woman in a way that will make a lasting impression, I think, on you.
Yes, the performance of the woman. All right. Well,
so we were saying we have a comment from a listener.
Yes, we have a comment from Steve Mason, who wrote into us via email. Just heard about your podcast a few weeks ago, and I'm trying to work my way through the first 40. They are fabulous. I've listened to the first 12 so far. But Steve makes a really excellent point that I wanted to share with our listeners and to see if anyone else has experienced this phenomenon as well. Steve writes, I know you continually point out that these podcasts are for all types of Sherlockians, new ones and longstanding ones. However, every once in a while, you'll be talking to one of your guests, such as Peter Blau, and will have an inside joke or an anecdote that, unfortunately, newer members to the hobby may not understand. Not sure you can always provide enough background for these types of anecdotes, but mindful of. Keep up the great work. Faithfully yours, Steve Mason.
Yeah, that's a great comment. That is a great comment.
It is. And, you know, it strikes me, you know, whether it's through a podcast or whether it's through discussion forums or even at some of the events that Dave and I have gone to, the cocktail receptions, et cetera. It's easy to get clubby and chummy with those that we've known for years here. And to an outsider or to a newbie, it might seem a little daunting to break into that. And it might seem a little, they might even be a little anxious to try and break into that conversation and understand really what it is that we're doing. So, I remember when I was a youngster, a whippersnapper, joining this group, that it was the people that made me feel included, the people that made me feel as if I was part of the club, that I had been there for a long time. And Peter, of course, himself is great at pulling people aside and explaining the significance of a comment or of a tradition or what have you. So, I think it's a point well taken, Steve, and one that we will try to adhere to as often as we can.
Yeah, you know, we should. Have we ever done a basics sort of a show? I mean, it's the tough thing to do to sort of summarize 75 years of sort of history and background and who was who and this, that, and the other thing. But that might be something to do.
I think we did one of the early episodes we did was kind of a Sherlockian 101. But, you know, there's so many different aspects to it, whether it's the people or the customs or the traditions or the stories or the scholarship. There's so many different aspects to it. You know, we could almost take Steve Doyle's Sherlock Holmes for Dummies and go through that chapter by chapter and discuss it and use that as kind of a guide as well. Maybe that's a roadmap for future episodes. Who knows?
Maybe. Well, it's a very good comment, and we will be more thoughtful about, you know, when we start ruminating and anecdoting about explaining some of the background.
Indeed, we will. Ah, well, that sound can mean only one thing.
Yes, that the bagpipes have been tuned again.
Yes, and Bert has leaned on the cue button.
Not a moment too soon.
Which means it's time for the editor's gas lamp. And I don't know about you, Bert, but I'm feeling rather gassy this evening.
Well, that's the advantage of doing this thing over Skype. If you hadn't mentioned it, I never would know.
You mean this isn't Smell-O-Vision?
No, thank goodness.
Oh, I'm sorry. No, I'm feeling gassy in terms of the editor's gas lamp. We have actually a lengthy gas lamp this time, but it's one that's probably more topically important. Taken from the volume 41, number 1, March 1991 issue of the Baker Street Journal, as edited by Philip A. Schreffler. Mm-hmm. This was the first issue of the Baker Street Journal that had been run after the January 1991 BSI dinner. The reason the January 1991 BSI dinner was so important is because that was the first time that women received investitures into the Baker Street Irregulars.
Now maybe with an eye towards Steve Mason's comment, you know, we should recap in just a couple of sentences some of the history here. I mean, basically, the Baker Street Irregulars was founded by a writer and playwright, a wonderful literary giant, Rhodes Scholar, a fellow named Christopher Morley. And it was one of a series of clubs that he had formed, and they were people really that he wanted to spend time with. They were sea captains and artists and writers and literary people, actors. They were people who fell in his circle. But because it began in the 1930s, it was very much sort of a men-only kind of thing, because in those days, no respectable single woman would be seen in a large gathering of men who were gathered for drinking and bawdy conversation and cigarette smoking and pipe smoking and cigar smoking and so on. So for most of its history up until then, the Baker Street Irregulars had been very much a men-only kind of operation.
It certainly did. And I know Tom Styx, who was the Wiggins at the time, made this decision, breaking with tradition, some 50 years of tradition. He took it very seriously, and he looked at the contribution of women throughout the history of the organization, and obviously recognized women that deserve to be recognized. And as this episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere is titled The Woman, we thought that it would be appropriate to read this editor's gas lamp, again from March 1991, which is simply titled Women.
And because it's so long, Scott and I are going to alternate the paragraphs to reduce somewhat the monotony that you may experience in hearing it. But shall I begin?
Please do.
In the 13 May 1934 issue of the Saturday Review of Literature, Christopher Morley published a crossword puzzle together with a note to the effect that those who submitted to him correct solutions, but they must be correct in every detail, will automatically become members of the Baker Street Irregulars. Morley's fondly regarded offspring, which had never actually convened physically. Ultimately, some 15 people shipped off perfect puzzle solutions to Morley at the Saturday Review, realizing, though, that his correct in every detail injunction was perhaps too rigorous. Morley relaxed BSI entrance requirements to include another 23 nearly perfect solutions.
What's interesting about those data is that of the 15 perfect solutions, 7 were submitted by women, and of the nearly perfect, at least 5. However, in Morley's typewritten invitation to the first formal meeting of the Baker Street Irregulars on 5 June 1934, he included, in an act of utter gasogenetic fiat, a concluding sentence that read, "This first meeting will be stag." No reason given. Possibly, when he originally printed the crossword, Morley thought, in an uncharacteristically unperceptive moment, that only the boys would apply for membership. Perhaps at some point, he turned to his brother, who had set the puzzle, and exclaimed, "Frank! Women have done this horrid thing, too." But whatever the circumstances, June of 1934 began a 57-year practice of the BSI as being a solely male sodality.
Never mind that the Grillparzer Zittenpolizeiverein, the Morley-esque club out of which the BSI evolved, was a sprightly intellectual convocation of both men and women. Never mind that the club's constitution and bylaws, composed by Elmer Davis in the BSI's natal year, clearly provided for female members, at least in concept. And never mind later both Edgar W. Smith and Julian Wolfe would invest women in the Irregulars, the former Lenore Glenn Offord and the latter Lisa McGaw. A tradition had been established, and among the Irregulars not a skirt was to be seen except for the rare kilt.
As it is with most traditions, the rationale for this one, had any ever existed, was forgotten. So explanations were cut from whole cloth. There had been no women in Holmes's original Irregulars, nor were there any well-educated adult males either, for that matter. Holmes's animadversions on women were well known, though Irene Adler was as special to him as any man, save Watson, and Watson welcomed women to 221B Baker Street at the drop of a kerchief. Victorian gentlemen's clubs did not admit women, but the BSI never clubbed in that way. It was founded as a literary society upon which women, even in Victorian times, attended frequently. In short, this exclusionary rule was as lame as a creeping man. Its only justification was precedent, a concept fundamentally valid only in courts of law.
With this year's investiture of 6 women, what the Baker Street Irregulars have done under their enlightened Wiggins is, after more than half a century, to honor the spirit of the club's publicly stated 1934 membership invitation and the implications of its constitution and bylaws. At long last, the BSI is what it said at its inception that it intended to be.
And though some may fear it, we have not toppled willy-nilly into a mindlessly liberated brave new world in this. To the contrary, what we've accomplished is conservative. We've reached down to the rich soil of the BSI's genesis to find the bright seeds of our origins. We've retreated into the New York of the 20s and 30s when the men and women of the Algonquin Roundtable and the Grill Parcha Club gathered to dine, often raucously, on steak, whiskey, and wit. We've reclaimed some of that hopeful enthusiasm, some of that genteel innocence.
And at the beginning, we were innocent. Robert Keith Levitt, who was party to the birth of the Baker Street Irregulars, reported that women were indeed present at the BSI's premier meeting, a publicity event largely sponsored by Doubleday and held at the Hotel Duane in New York on 6 January 1934, preceding the first formal meeting in June. Levitt admitted years later that he recalled little of the affair, except that those assembled played a game called sardines, a sort of hide-and-seek in reverse. The one person who is it steals away and hides, and all the others look for him, or, you understand, her, and anyone finding her crawls into the same hiding place, and so for each additional finder as they accumulate. At length, as you can see, the hiders, now being sought by only one or two questers, get very sardine-compressed, but if there are enough pretty ladies, correspondingly happy.
The birth of the BSI. Later, Levitt grumpily referred to women as grit in the Irregulars' works. It seems to us that there was something of an approach avoidance conflict, as the psychologists style it, going on there.
But for our part, the journal is perfectly serene. We will take the grit. We'll welcome the grit, for to do so is to cleave unto what we were all about at the start, the foregathering in joy of bookish folk of both sexes to celebrate Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson.
Now, if we can only convince Wiggins to reinstate sardines, our traditions will have come full circle. And there's an interesting note from Wiggins. Because at this point in the BSJ's history, the editorship was separate from the leadership of the BSI itself. Of course, when Edgar Smith founded it, he was the defender of the BSI and the editor of the journal, so he could have his say any time. But in this case, Tom Sticks, the Wiggins, adds a postscript to the editor's gas lamp. I would like to express my gratitude to all those Sherlockians who sent me letters of support regarding the extraordinary circumstances of the 1991 Baker Street Irregulars annual gathering. The very first of these came from Donald Isbin of Chicago, who wrote, "Congratulations again on an excellent Sherlockian weekend. Unqualified support like this makes the job of Wiggins considerably easier than it otherwise might be."
Well, you know, I mean, to Steve Mason's comment, I mean, I suppose it's worth spending a moment or two just to reflect how bizarre this probably seems to many of the people who are listening to this. You know, the idea that introducing women into the Baker Street Irregulars was ever a big deal. But it was very much a big deal. And in fact, in the 1970s, in at least one memorable occasion, the premises of the Baker Street Irregulars dinner was picketed by women who were protesting the fact of their exclusion, and many right-thinking and scholarly and brilliant women they were, too. And they're now
indeed
still very much with us.
And I believe a number of those women who were on that picket line, it was either the late 60s or early 70s, went on to become that first investitured class of women.
Mm.
In 1991. So the honor was due to them some 20 years on. Mm-hmm. And of course, in the interim, to kind of thumb their nose at the BSI was to create a women-only society called the Adventuresses of Sherlock Holmes.
Mm-hmm.
Inasmuch as Irene Adler was an adventuress, the Adventuresses kind of styled themselves after her and did things their own way. And they still meet to this day. They refer to themselves as Ash, so you may see some people with BSI after their name. You'll see other people with Ash after their name. And they meet every Wednesday in New York. They're Ash Wednesdays, as they call them, which is really interesting because a number of these original founding women came from Albertus Magnus College, which is, of course, a Catholic university. So Ash Wednesday was right in line with their teachings. And, of course, they have the Serpentine Muse as their publication, which is done, I believe, 4 times a year as well. So something for everyone out there. And I know The Adventuress is just about 5 years ago or so went co-ed themselves. They, of course, allowed men and women to their regular meetings all the time, but their official dinner every year, from my understanding, was women only. And the membership of the dinner was women only, with two major exceptions, Peter Blau and John Bennett Shaw, who each showed some concern about these original women who had picketed the line of the BSI. So memories are long, and rewards are given for the appropriate kind of behavior, and ultimately the right way wins through, as you've seen from the BSI and the Adventuresses of Sherlock Holmes.
For those of you who find, you know, who just find this very bizarre, you know, you have to remember that a large part, I think, of what led the Baker Street Irregulars to be a men-only group for such a long while was, you know, the fact that there was a great fear that that relaxed aspect of the thing would fail if members of the fair sex were present at the doings. And to this day, there are still some Sherlockian societies that remain steadfastly all male, and they continue in their exalted traditions.
Indeed. And if you can't make it to one of the all male gatherings, that is, if you have to have a member to be a member, there are lots of alternatives out there for you. There are, I know, in every city where there is an all-male Sherlockian organization, there are very few left. There are also co-ed clubs, or in some cases, women-only clubs. So there's something out there for everyone. Yeah. And I'm sure you can find what works for you.
Yeah. And the other thing is, you know, we should do a show with, you know, Susan and Mickey and Mary Ellen and some of the gang, and do a show on Ash and the Adventuresses.
I would love that. I think, well, we've set ourselves up for a future show. Oh, you heard it here, folks.
Very, very good.
Hold our feet to the fire. If we don't produce, then come after us.
Yes.
Hey, have you got that great breaking news theme available, Bert? Wow. You know, after that kind of an introduction, I feel like I really have to have something groundbreaking.
Yes, you're not
sure how groundbreaking.
You're not terminating your campaign for the presidency.
No, nor am I starting one.
Oh,
thank
good.
Goodness. We just got this in I just found it over the weekend. It was posted back in March, but I thought it was really interesting, an exclusive given to Deadline New York, deadline.com, said that Elton John's Rocket Pictures has set up the 3D animated Romeo and Juliet Sherlock Gnomes as a sequel to the 2011 Disney hit that grossed $194 million worldwide. Andy Reilly and Kevin Cecil, who wrote the original, are writing the sequel script. The gnomes start disappearing from suburban gardens of England. Romeo, Juliet, and their friends enlist the help of Sherlock Gnomes, the greatest ornamental detective, to track the culprit. Unfortunately, Sherlock is neither as brilliant nor as insightful as his human counterpart, and the crimes against humanity continue. The threat to the world becomes bigger than they ever imagined.
Oh, my goodness.
Now, I don't know if this is something of a spoof. I haven't seen any other news of this. We'll see how this actually rolls out, but could be interesting. And as much as Conan Doyle was taken by the Cottingley fairies, the garden gnomes may be the very next step. At the very least, we should get Travelocity to look into this.
Yes. Well, speaking of getting people to look into things, we are eager for your feedback. And please follow Steve Mason by sending us an email. Give us a call at 774-221-READ. That's 774-221-7323. Leave us a message. We'd be happy to play it during a future show. Go to our Facebook page. Go to IHearOfSherlock.com. Go to any street corner in a major metropolitan city where there is no Coca-Cola machine and whisper into the traffic sign, and we will get your feedback.
Or just scream out on the street corner at will. I hear of Sherlock everywhere.
I believe in Sherlock.
Yes, and I don't, and I'm not going to take it anymore.
I believe in hearing of Sherlock.
Yes, we would love to hear from you, and thank you so much for spending these precious few minutes. Maybe it's an hour with us. Who knows? At the end of this production time, but we really do appreciate your patronage, and please tell some folks about it if you enjoy the show.
Yes, and that gets us to the point where I have to recognize, unfortunately, that I'm Bert Wolder.
And that must mean I have to recognize that I'm Scott Monty, and that means
the game's afoot.
I'm afraid that in the pleasure of this conversation, I'm neglecting business of importance, which awaits me elsewhere.
Thank you for listening. Please be sure to join us again for the next episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, the first podcast dedicated to Sherlock Holmes.
Goodbye, and good luck, and believe me to be, my dear fellow, very sincerely yours, Sherlock Holmes.